Applications for the Thomistic Institute's Study Abroad Program's Spring 2025 semester close on March 20th. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for college students to explore Rome's intellectual tradition at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas Aquinas. Limited spots are available. For more information, visit thomisticinstitute.org/Rome. That's thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
It's good to be with you. Thank you all for coming. I realize in our time, one of the things that is hard to do is to hold attention. Particularly post-COVID, we're finding that the numbers of people who will co-hear a lecture have gone down. I think we've all lost some of our capacity to focus. So I'm going to try to speak for about half an hour to 35 minutes, and then if you along the way have questions come to your mind, maybe write them down or thumb them into your notes on your phone, and hopefully we'll have a good amount of time for discussion this afternoon. And I should say at the beginning, greetings from my colleagues. How many of you guys are in healthcare or think you're on your way to work in healthcare? All right, good. So at Duke, we have a program that's quite unique. It's called the Theology, Medicine, and Culture Initiative. My position at Duke, my primary appointment is in the Ethics Center, but I have a joint appointment in the Divinity School. And we have a program out of the Divinity School that invites people with vocations to healthcare to come and spend a year or two studying in-depth Christian tradition and how Christian tradition gives shapes one's imagination for the world of healthcare. We trained 90 fellows in the last 9 years, and they're now all over American healthcare and a lot of prominent academic medical centers, and we'd love to have you come. We have both a residential program or a hybrid program, which is designed for practicing clinicians. If any of you are in a place where you can't necessarily move, but you'd like to study some more, check us out. I've left next to Evan there, and I'll have up here some flyers if anyone's interested. All right, here we go. So that's the program. So consider this case. LC's a 50-year-old carpenter. He and his wife are proud parents of twin daughters. And one day, LC's wife notices his eyes look yellow, and LC goes to see his doctor. Imaging reveals a tumor in the pancreas with multiple lesions in the liver. A procedure is done to place a stent in LC's bile duct, and biopsies confirm what everyone fears: metastatic pancreatic cancer. I want you to want us to think together about what it means to care well for LC, to be a good medical practitioner to him in the future he faces, and to think about how palliative medicine, which is my clinical discipline, fits into good medicine for LC, and then also to think about medical aid in dying. Since the positive pressure mechanical ventilator was developed in the late 1960s, there has been widespread concern that the default pathway for those who die within healthcare institutions, like ECU's hospital nearby, and certainly Duke's hospital, this default pathway traps patients in a technologically driven institutional matrix that imposes undue suffering and isolates them from their communities. Have you seen this, any of you? Probably with a loved one? The primary strategy to address this problem has been to expand and to enhance palliative care and hospice. And these have been expanded markedly, so much so that today LC's physician is likely to offer or even recommend a palliative approach to his illness. That's to say, an approach that will focus on his symptom control and function, will set aside chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. And palliative care does a lot to help patients who are dying. The first thing it does is it provides a viable alternative to that default pathway. It helps you get off this technological medicine train. This default pathway for dying in the United States healthcare system makes it hard for patients like Elsie to die well because it puts off preparation for death through vain promises to extend life indefinitely, while it absorbs time, attention, and resources that could be put toward more worthwhile ends. So, for example, long before getting to this point, driving back and forth to the hospital leaves less time for reconciling with one's husband or wife or one's neighbors. And it's difficult to pray or to write letters to one's children or to organize one's estate while retching from chemotherapy. Hospice and palliative medicine also create a recognizable, what we might call, social space in which a patient can be described as dying and not merely sick. And because it creates this space, it allows patients to take on the dying role. In his book, Being Mortal, the surgeon writer Atul Gawande writes that one of our challenges in caring well for those who are dying is that it's hard to say when someone is dying. Because, he writes, technology can sustain our organs until we are well past the point of awareness and coherence. How then do you attend to the thoughts and concerns of the dying when medicine has made it almost impossible to be sure who the dying even are? Is someone with terminal cancer, dementia, or incurable heart failure dying exactly? So we might ask, is LC dying? One of the refreshing aspects of my work in hospice is that when I encounter patients in hospice, the pretense of fixing the problem is gone. Everyone has agreed that the patient is dying. Maybe not right now, but soon and for certain. And moreover, by locating the social space of dying within the geographical space of the patient's home, by moving patients into home hospice, and by opening the geographical space of the hospital to accommodate the presence and participation of the home community, as frequently happens on palliative wards or on hospice wards, hospice and palliative care removes institutional barriers that, in the default pathway, keep patients and patients' family and friends and clergy off balance and at arm's length. It helps patients, family, friends, neighbors, and clergy to feel welcomed and empowered to contribute what LC needs to die well. If you've gone to visit someone in the hospital in the ICU, you probably felt awkward and a sense of, I hope I don't step on something I'm not supposed to step on, or trip over a wire, or get in the way. Am I supposed to be over here? Can we turn it off? You feel very much out of place in that setting. It's very foreign. Hospice and palliative medicine tries to kind of break that foreignness down, bringing people in and then taking people into their home space. So let's suppose that 2 weeks after his diagnosis, LC returns to see his primary physician. He looks tired and sad, and he tearfully notes that he's not sleeping well, and he cannot concentrate or enjoy anything because he's so anxious about what lies ahead. I'm not ready to die, LC says. Why would God do this to me? This presentation, the way Elsie's presenting to his doctor here, it highlights another way that hospice and palliative care helps patients who are dying, and that's by attending to the spiritual dimensions of the patient's experience. The National Consensus Project for Quality Palliative Care identifies spiritual, religious, and existential aspects of care as the fifth of eight core domains of palliative care. And the National Consensus Project is not alone. From the World Health Organization, to the International Association for Hospice and Palliative Care, to the Joint Commission for the Accreditation of Hospitals, contemporary visions of quality end-of-life care universally include attention to the patient as a spiritual being. So in all these ways, hospice and palliative care helps patients who are dying, and that's, interestingly, prior to relieving any symptoms, right? Prior to treating pain or any other symptoms. But I propose to you that palliative care can also undermine and contradict the possibility of LC dying well. And it does so, I think, when it removes the conditions necessary for patients like LC to participate in what was once called the Ars Moriendi. This term, Ars Moriendi, which simply means the art of dying, refers to a literature that emerged in the Middle Ages in response to the plague. So many people were dying in Europe that the church could not keep up with the usual rituals and practices of accompanying with those who were dying. And in response, the church affirmed and helped to promulgate a set of prints and booklets to guide lay people and those around them in preparing to die faithfully and as well as one can under these terrible circumstances. For my purposes, when I use the term Ars Moriendi, at least in this lecture, I'm referring simply to the idea of dying well, which, as we're going to see in a minute, is different from the conventional notion, the much more common language used in my world, which is the notion of a good death. So how might medicine sometimes remove the conditions necessary for a patient like Elsie to participate in the Ars Moriendi? It often happens unintentionally. The medications that we use to relieve symptoms have side effects. Narcotics and tranquilizers and antipsychotics can be very useful for relieving pain and anxiety and restlessness, but they also can diminish consciousness. They can render patients passive to the experience of dying and put patients existentially out of reach of the communities, of their communities and their clinicians. Many of my patients and their family members have voiced this concern, which opens questions about medical aid in dying. Not long ago, I was asked to see a patient in the emergency room of one of our hospitals. This is not him. This is obviously a drawing, but we're going to call him Mr. Roberts. He's a real patient. Mr. Roberts is not his real name either, but patient I saw. He had advanced dementia, and he was brought to the hospital by his brother and his niece, who for several years had cared for him at home. Mr. Roberts had pneumonia, and he was beginning to suffer septic shock and respiratory failure, meaning he was not going to be able to breathe on his own much longer. And after I spoke with him briefly, Mr. Roberts' brother and niece consented to my proposal that we give him antibiotics, oxygen, and other supportive therapy, but that we forego putting him on a breathing machine, a ventilator, even if he came to the point of not being able to breathe on his own, that at that point we would accept that he was dying. I asked them then if they had ever considered hospice care and for Mr. Roberts, and they both immediately shook their head like they were kind of startled I'd even bring that up. And they said adamantly, "We're not interested in hospice." Why, I asked. And they responded as I've heard many others respond, both on the south side of Chicago, where I practiced hospice medicine for several years, and in Durham, North Carolina, where I've practiced for the last decade. They said hospice too often foregoes any effort to provide medical care for patients, instead focusing only on making them comfortable through potent drugs like morphine and sedatives, and that thereby it hastens patients' death. So that was my encounter with Mr. Roberts. I'm going to come back to Mr. Roberts in a moment when we talk a little more about medical aid in dying. But how can we and how should we navigate a tension between relieving LC's suffering or Mr. Roberts' suffering and then not diminishing the conditions needed for LC to die well? Navigating this tension begins, I think, with recognizing that relieving suffering is not the only good at stake in these situations. That if we render LC or another patient, any patient, we render patients unable to consciously participate in preparing for death, we have caused the loss of something valuable. And medical practitioners, in my experience, often overlook this fact. Indeed, it often seems as if the goal of comfort, which is a really powerful word in our culture and in our healthcare system, this goal of comfort comes to displace all other goals, making the loss of consciousness seem like a trivial thing, not really a big deal. I propose that to help those who are dying to die well without undermining that possibility, palliation should be understood as a set of practices that are internal to medicine, rather than as a rival form of professionalized care. And as part of medicine, palliation should be directed toward health, aiming to relieve suffering just insofar as suffering is related to health. And here we begin to see, I think, how contemporary medicine and medical ethics go wrong in a way that terminates in medical aid and dying. They go wrong when they deny that medicine has a rational end, an intelligible, reasonable purpose that we don't merely make up, but instead we recognize and respect, and which gives medical practitioners a standard to guide their practices. An end for our practice that helps us know what it is we're up to, what it is we're trying to achieve, and what sort of things we shouldn't do because of that end. Now, there have been times and places in which it was axiomatic. Everybody knew that the purpose of medicine was health. Aristotle wrote, for example, "Now, since there are many actions, arts, and sciences," this is from his Nicomachean Ethics, he says, "since there are many actions, arts, and sciences, their ends also are many. The end of the medical art is health, that of shipbuilding a vessel, that of strategy victory, that of economics wealth." So again, Aristotle, if you've ever read his Ethics, it's remarkably, particularly if you've read much philosophy, it's remarkably intelligible and clear and simple. But he begins with, like, how do we get started trying to understand ourselves and understand our moral lives? And he starts with what, one way to summarize this is, he starts with what the many and the wise know. Like, what are the things that we all know that are not really points of dispute? These are the kinds of things we know. We know that the point of building a ship is, or shipbuilding is a ship. The point of military strategy is to win the wars, to have victory. The point of economics is to generate wealth. And the point of medicine is health. It's no longer true that these are things that necessarily you can take for granted. Deep cultural shifts in modernity have resulted in widespread skepticism regarding any claims about the proper ends of human identities and activities, including the ends of medicine. Which is to say, in our time, to propose that there's a purpose for being human that's knowable is, for many people, is going to seem like you're trying to basically shuttle in through some power move your own personal kind of values and put them on others. And similarly, with respect to medicine, to say that medicine has a particular end feels in our culture like you're trying to kind of take over and direct a practice toward what you want rather than what someone else might want or need. If the end of medicine is health, then practitioners who focus on palliation have good reason to do things that preserve and restore health, and to not do things that diminish health or undermine the conditions necessary for patients to entrust themselves to physicians when their health is threatened or diminished. It may seem counterintuitive to think of palliation as aiming at health. Palliation, it seems, is what we do precisely when health can no longer be restored. So when, to take Elsie as an example, we know we'll never again say about this person that he or she is healthy. But this common way of thinking, I think, misunderstands both health and palliation. Leon Cass, who was a chair for years of the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago, where I was for 15 years, was chaired the President's Council on Bioethics under George W. Bush's administration. And he, in a 1972 essay, put it this way. The essay was called "Regarding the End of Medicine and the Pursuit of Health." He said, "Health is the well-working of the organism as a whole, or put another way, an activity of the body in accord with its specific excellences." Great essay if any of you guys are interested in thinking about what medicine is for. And there was a lot unpacked there, but as an example, he held up the health of a squirrel. He said, "The health of a squirrel is displayed in the characteristic activities of squirrels when they're well working, right? Such as burying nuts, chattering, climbing trees, beating their tails. This is what squirrels do when squirrels are being squirrely, as they should. Because the characteristic activities of humans are more varied, so are their expressions of health. But expressions certainly include, such expressions certainly include the capacity to move one's bowels, I think we'd all agree, to eat and digest food without vomiting it up, to sit or recline or lay down or walk without racking pain, to stay awake and to sleep at the proper times. These are all dimensions of humans when they're well working as humans. And health also is a matter of degree. So we can't return LC, now that he has metastatic pancreatic cancer, to a state of health that he had before his diagnosis. But if physicians help him along the way to go from nausea, constipation, insomnia, and racking pain to tolerating food, moving his bowels, sleeping 6 hours a night, moving around free of debilitating pain, then they will have contributed to his health, I think, objectively. And it's just these sort of contributions that make it possible for someone like Elsie to engage in the Ars Moriendi, to engage the tasks of living well in the face of death. Now, here's an important distinction that comes into view. It's one thing for medical practitioners to palliate disabling symptoms with an eye to preserving and restoring a measure of health, a measure, again, that makes it possible for the patient to participate in dying well, which is just to say to participate in living as well as possible in the face of death. It's another thing for healthcare professionals to palliate symptoms without respect to whether doing so restores health. And I think, in my observation, physicians are tempted to elide this distinction or to regard it as of no clinical ethical significance. So let's go back to our case and say that LC goes through chemotherapy, his disease progresses, he sees his primary physician and says, "Doc, I don't want to languish and suffer in the final stages of this disease. If I come to the point which I cannot tolerate living any longer, and if I ask you to do so, would you sedate me until I'm unconscious and keep me that way until I die?" At a later visit, he adds, "It's very important for me to have some autonomy and control at the end of life. I don't expect I'll need to use it, but would you provide me a prescription for medicines that I can take to end my life if I can't go on?" So, question for us to think about is, how is it that LC, along with, I should say, the good people of California, Oregon, Washington, the District of Columbia, Colorado, Vermont, Hawaii, Montana, New Jersey, the whole country of Canada, Belgium, the Netherlands, New Zealand, the list keeps growing year by year. Folks have come to see so-called death with dignity, which is the language that's used in the U.S. law where these statutes have been passed, or medical aid in dying, as it's called in Canada and in New Zealand and other places, come to see these as perhaps the most reasonable course of action when they face the prospect of losing their capacities. Death with dignity and medical aid in dying are euphemisms for physicians helping patients to die, either by giving them a prescription for lethal drugs that patients can take to end their own lives. That's what's legal in the jurisdictions in the U.S. It is more plainly described as physician-assisted suicide. Or by killing the patient directly, usually through injecting lethal drugs, which is what is done in 99% of cases in Canada, technically called voluntary euthanasia. Note that while LC is interested in these practices, the family of Mr. Roberts, my patient in the emergency room, were worried about these practices, which I think raises the question that we'll kind of wrap up with here in the next several minutes. And the question is, which should physicians care about most? Which should medical practitioners care about most? Maintaining the trust of those who, like Mr. Roberts and his family, already experienced the debility, dependence, and suffering that advanced illness brings, or empowering those who, like the young woman Brittany Maynard, seek through assisted suicide to avoid such debility, dependence, and suffering. Now, I realize most of you guys in the room are too young probably to remember Brittany Maynard, but she was diagnosed with brain cancer in January 2014, and she became a prominent public advocate for legalization of physician-assisted suicide, again, under the language of death with dignity. She moved from California, which did not have physician-assisted suicide legalized at that point, to Oregon, And per a plan that she had specified in advance, on November 1st of that year, she ingested a lethal cocktail of drugs and died. Brittany Maynard's story illustrates a pattern. Those who seek physician-assisted death are rarely driven by the direct experience of refractory pain or other symptoms. This is important, and there's a lot of data that bears this out. So it's not that they have pain or breathlessness that cannot be relieved. Rather, as Ms. Maynard said directly, she wrote this, she was tracked by CNN.com throughout this experience. And as she said directly, she chose to end her life to avoid the prospect of further debility and decline, in which she might, quote, suffer personality changes and verbal, cognitive, and motor loss of virtually any kind. Her desire to avoid debility and dependence reflects a pattern found in official reports from Oregon and Washington State, where 9 out of 10 patients requesting assisted suicide have reported being concerned about losing autonomy and being less able to engage in activities making life enjoyable. So the problem to which assisted suicide poses a solution, it's not uncontrolled pain. In Oregon, only 1 in 4 patients, 24.7%, has reported even being concerned about the possibility of inadequate pain control. And at no time in history have physicians and patients had greater access to effective tools for treating pain and other distressing symptoms, tools which can be deployed aggressively under ethical norms that have guided medicine for centuries. I will say, you know, again, taking care of hundreds and hundreds of patients who have died, and apart from, maybe we can talk about this in the Q&A if y'all are interested, rare cases of what I would call terminal delirium, for lack of a better term, an intense agitated delirium, even in which cases, even then we can relieve that with adequate sedation. I've never found a patient whose symptoms could not be relieved under traditional ethical norms. The problem to which assisted suicide poses a solution is the problem of a loss of control in the face of debilitating illness. In an article a few years ago published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Timothy Quill, who's probably the foremost physician advocate for assisted suicide over the past 20 years, quite famous, he and colleagues wrote, quote, "Patients with serious illness wish to have control over their own bodies, their own lives, and concern about future physical and psychosocial distress." And Brittany Maynard put the point bluntly in her online manifesto, "I want to die on my own terms," she wrote. There's more to be said than I can say here, but it seems to me evident that the cultures of late modern Western wealthy societies don't seem to form in their members imaginations capable of receiving unwanted suffering and loss of control as anything other than meaningless burdens, much less capable of receiving these burdens as invitations to live well in the face of debility and death. In contemporary Western culture, then, it seems to many people as if the only reasonable response to unwanted suffering, the only compassionate response for sure, is to get rid of it. And under this cultural pressure, the medical profession has steadily been setting aside, enthusiasts might say overcoming, the constraints imposed by aiming only at health, and the profession's been taking on more expansive aims. For example, World Health Organization defines palliative care as, quote, "an approach that improves the quality of life of patients and their families facing the problems associated with life-threatening illness through the prevention and relief of suffering by means of early identification and impeccable assessment and treatment of pain and other problems, physical, psychosocial, and spiritual." Now, note, if you would, how this formulation gives palliative care a seemingly boundless scope of responsibility. What problems, after all, are excluded from the categories of physical, psychosocial, and spiritual? Note also that in this formulation, medicine does not aim to preserve and restore a measure of health, but rather to relieve suffering and improve quality of life. And when you take efforts to relieve suffering and to improve quality of life, and those break free of the limitations imposed by medicine's traditional orientation to the patient's health, physicians begin to see all sorts of suffering, including existential or spiritual suffering, identity mismatch suffering, all kinds of suffering, as conditions which call for medical treatment. Because palliative care in particular seeks to minimize suffering and maximize quality of life, because suffering and quality of life can only be assessed authoritatively by the sufferer, I cannot tell any of you guys what you're actually suffering. That's just of the nature of suffering. Because of that, palliative care practitioners have come to trade their own clinical judgment, in many cases, for the direction given by patient preferences. And the language of patient preferences links the goal of control over one's destiny that Brittany Maynard voiced, together with the goal of freedom from unwanted suffering. The American Association of Hospice and Palliative Medicine makes this link explicit. The goal of palliative care is to prevent and relieve suffering and to support the best possible quality of life for patients and their families, regardless of their stage of disease or the need for other therapies, in accordance with their values and preferences. So if LC's physician sets out to minimize LC's suffering, maximize his quality of life, and do so in accordance with his values and preferences, then it starts to seem that the physician has a good reason to aim at LC's death itself as one of her goals. And a growing proportion of the public and the medical profession think just this way. The palliative care literature now speaks much less about relieving disabling symptoms so that patients can live as well as possible in the face of advanced illness and dying. And it speaks more about treating unwanted symptoms so that patients can die comfortably, and doing that according to goal concordant care. Just to give one prominent example of that literature, the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization describes hospice as follows. Hospice affirms the concept of palliative care as an intensive program that enhances comfort and provides the quality of life for individuals and promotes the quality of life for individuals and their families. When cure is no longer possible, hospice recognizes that a peaceful and comfortable death is an essential goal of healthcare. So note these shifts. You have a shift from aiming at health to maximizing quality of life, from proportionate relief of symptoms to minimizing suffering, and from helping patients who are dying in hopes they might die as well as possible to helping patients to die by giving them a good death, where a good death is a death that the patient chooses and which is as free of suffering as possible. After Brittany Maynard said, "I want to die on my own terms," she asked, "Who has the right to tell me I don't deserve this choice?" And that's a powerful question in our day. The former Hemlock Society is now called Compassion and Choices. The California law legalizing assisted suicide was called the End of Life Options Act. When Governor Jerry Brown signed it, he said he did not know, he was a Catholic governor. He said, "I don't know if I would avail myself of assisted suicide, but I wouldn't deny that right to others." The choice looms large. But what kind of choice is Ms. Maynard and others like her being denied if physicians refuse to participate in assisted suicide? She already had the right to refuse life-sustaining treatment, as does everyone else. She had the right to palliation of her symptoms, even if death were hastened as a side effect of such palliation, which is something that can be done under, again, centuries-old ethical norms. She had the liberty to cause her own death by numerous methods which do not involve physicians and which are equally, if not more, efficient and effective than ingesting a slurry of pharmaceuticals. I don't mean to be crass, but there are a lot of ways to cause one's own death that are more efficient and effective, more reliable than that. Why must physicians in particular cooperate in helping her and others to kill themselves? That physicians are being asked to cooperate suggests, I think, that the right to choose is, as the late Robert Burt noted, it's radically incomplete as a justification for physician-assisted suicide. The confident assertion of the self-determination right, he continued, leaves unacknowledged and unanswered a crucial background question. Who can be trusted to care for me when I'm too vulnerable and fearful to care for myself? And that's not a rhetorical question for folks like Mr. Roberts' family, who've come to the conclusion that some physicians who wield the tools of palliative medicine are not to be trusted, because such physicians have so prioritized relieving suffering that they fail to do what physicians count on physicians to do, which is to use reasonable means to preserve the health and life of the patient. So here's the rub. Physicians cannot practice causing the death of their patients, I think, without undermining the trust on which the practice of medicine depends. And this is not a new insight. Physicians have long known that both they and their patients will at times be tempted to do away with suffering by doing away with the sufferer. This is a timeless temptation. And to keep that temptation at bay, for example, for more than two millennia, many physicians have sworn in the Hippocratic Oath, "I will neither give a deadly drug to anybody who asks for it, nor will I make a suggestion to this effect." The World Medical Association has opposed assisted suicide and euthanasia since it was formed and issued the Declaration of Geneva just after the Second World War. The AMA has maintained since its founding that physician-assisted suicide is fundamentally inconsistent with the physician's professional role, though I should say that later this week it will again face a proposal to change that opposition. This will be the second time in 5 years. We'll see. Arguably, insofar as physicians enjoy the trust of patients made vulnerable by illness, it's because, since Hippocrates at least, they've maintained solidarity with those who are sick and disabled, seeking only to heal and refusing to use their skills and powers to do harm. That's why physicians have refused to participate in capital punishment or to be active combatants or to help patients commit suicide. And importantly, this boundary against intentionally causing the patient's death not only gives patients a reason to trust physicians, but it gives physicians the freedom they need to do their work. For example, with Mr. Roberts, I was able to tell his family that as a physician, I'm never going to intentionally hasten a patient's death. Never. And that boundary creates a space in which physicians like me can act decisively to palliate distressing symptoms. So I could tell them that the morphine I was going to give them, I could use the morphine that was necessary to relieve Mr. Roberts' dyspnea. And if I didn't have that boundary, if they didn't know that I wasn't trying to hasten his death, then I think they have good reason to worry that I'm dosing that not in proportion to his breathlessness, but out of an effort to kind of ease things along, to hurry up the dying process. So let me close here by returning to the question of solidarity I posed earlier. Which should be most important to medical practitioners? Maintaining the trust of those who, like Mr. Roberts and his family, already experience the debility, dependence, and suffering that advanced illness brings? Or empowering those who, like Brittany Maynard, seek through assisted suicide to avoid such debility, dependence, and suffering? The witness of physicians and patients through the centuries and into the present has affirmed that we cannot have it both ways. A few years ago, I mentioned Timothy Quill, and a few years ago we had a debate, he and I, at Duke University on this topic. And the night of our debate, across town at the Durham Performing Arts Center, Reality Ministries of Durham, North Carolina, was having its 10th annual talent show. The performers included dozens of people with developmental disabilities who, to borrow Ms. Maynard's terms, suffer verbal, cognitive, and motor loss of virtually every kind. These performers drew an audience of roughly 1,000 persons, and as the organizers promised, inspired, encouraged, and empowered in a way that no other show can, because somehow this show tells people something about God's presence in our midst. Whether or not you're persuaded that God is present in our midst, the performers at the Reality Talent Show display a truth that Brittany Maynard and many others cannot see, or she could not see, and others cannot see. And that is that debility and dependence do not render lives not worth living, that human dignity does not require living or dying on one's own terms. That truth is obscured, I think, by a culture that emphasizes success and productivity youthfulness and beauty, autonomy and control. So look again at the public images of Ms. Maynard. It's not incidental that those who advocate for and avail themselves of assisted suicide are overwhelmingly white, well-off, and accustomed to being able-bodied. In fact, according to official reports, the first 1,000 people who died in Oregon by assisted suicide, only one was black. Statistically, one would have expected at least 20. 2.1% of the population is black, according to the census. In Washington State, only 2% of deaths by assisted suicide were non-white, whereas 20% of the population is non-white. In California in 2018, of the 337 people who died by physician-assisted suicide, 3 were black, less than 1%. 13 were Hispanic, less than 4%. California is 39% Hispanic. Mr. Roberts' family, like most of my patients in Chicago and Durham, was black. And if verbal, cognitive, and motor loss renders life not worth living, you might think that disability groups at least would welcome assisted suicide. But the opposite is the case. Disability groups overwhelmingly oppose assisted suicide. The prominent advocacy group Not Dead Yet speaks for many in arguing that it cannot be seriously maintained that legalization of assisted suicide will not lead to inappropriate pressures from family or society for people to end their lives. The group contends that assisted suicide laws ensure legal immunity for physicians who already devalue the lives of older and disabled people and have significant economic incentives to at least agree with their suicides, if not encourage them, or worse. It seems unjust, then, for physicians to facilitate yet another choice for those accustomed to having life, to living life, on their own terms, white, wealthy, well-off, at the cost of betraying physicians' distinctive solidarity with and thereby undermining the trust of those who live under the terms of illness and disability, which they haven't chosen, people like Mr. Roberts, they haven't chosen, but with respect to which they should be able to count on physicians' care. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.